Good evening. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Today, our guest is Amanda Ryman, and she is the Vice President of Community Development at Flocana. In just a moment, Amanda will be back, and she will tell us all about what she is up to. I think you'll find it fascinating. And also, if you're at all interested in being our guest and talk about how you're using business as a force for good on the planet, please email us at heartstockradio@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook. We're going to take a little segue here. We'll be right back with Amanda. Thanks for listening. Our guest today on Heartstock is Amanda Ryman at Flocana. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being our guest on Heartstock. Please give our listeners a little intro, what it is that you do, and a little bit about your background.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm Vice President of Community Development for Flocana, which is a branded cannabis distribution company here in California, but I know that we're going to get into that a little bit more later in the show. I grew up in the Midwest in Indiana and Chicago and Detroit, and then moved out to California in 2002 to get my PhD at UC Berkeley. And I was studying social welfare at a time when the medical cannabis movement was really starting to proliferate in the Bay Area. And I was a medical cannabis patient myself. I've had arthritis since my early 20s. And so I was very much interested from a public health and a social work perspective of the early dispensary model and how it was serving marginalized individuals in the communities in the Bay Area. So I decided to do my doctoral dissertation on how medical cannabis dispensaries were operating as health service providers. And this was in 2005, when we really still didn't know a whole lot about the medical cannabis movement or patients or why they were using cannabis. And so I used my public health research background to do some of the very first studies on medical cannabis patients. And that is kind of what led me to this work. It was really through a social work and public health lens. And then I worked in cannabis activism for many years with the Drug Policy Alliance, which is a national nonprofit that does drug policy reform work in the context of social justice, and then started working for Flocana up here in Northern California a few years ago.
And what is it that is, maybe just talk a little bit more about Flocana as well. What's their mission, and why did you decide to go to work for them specifically?
So a little bit about Flocana. We were founded in 2015 as a bicycle delivery service for cannabis in San Francisco. And from the very beginnings of the company, the focus of the company was really connecting with sun-grown, sustainably produced cannabis in the northern area of California known as the Emerald Triangle, which makes up Mendocino, Humboldt, and Trinity counties. And it's really responsible for producing most of the country's cannabis. If you think about Sonoma and Napa for wine, it's very similar in terms of the Emerald Triangle and cannabis production. So Flocana really from the very beginning had its design set on connecting the consumer with the farmer. So similarly to how we see farmers markets and people buying produce from their local farmer and wanting to know how that produce was created and what kind of environmental hazards or benefits came from its production, we felt that cannabis consumers wanted the same information. And under prohibition, consumers really didn't have the benefit of knowing the source of their cannabis. They were buying from an illicit market. They were buying products that wasn't tested, where they didn't know where it came from or how it was grown. And so we wanted to instill some of the same values and philosophies into the cannabis marketplace that we see in the slow food, local food movement. So that is how Flokana started. And then with impending legalization, we wanted to look at other agricultural models that were being used to lift up large networks of independently owned farms rather than to vertically integrate and to grow everything ourselves. So we built a processing center up here in Mendocino County for the purposes of aggregating product from the individual independently owned farms in the region and doing centralized processing, packaging, and distribution to the licensed dispensaries across the state. So not unlike we see coffee production or chocolate or other botanicals that become products but still have a story and a farm standing behind that product. And so that's been our model since the beginning, and that is what we're doing now, except instead of doing some bicycle deliveries, we're delivering to hundreds of dispensaries across the state of California.
I'm really curious about some of your research and what you found. Can you touch on the high points of your research?
Sure. So my research at the very beginning, the goal was really to find out how patients were using cannabis, because we didn't even know. And when I did my dissertation research and collected data on 130 patients in 2005, that was the largest sample of medical cannabis patients in existence at 130, which really tells you that it wasn't that long ago that we really did not have a lot of knowledge of how individuals were using this very old and very sacred plant. One of the things I found in my early studies was that there were a great number of patients reporting that they were using cannabis as a substitute for something else, usually alcohol or prescription drugs, and that they were reporting that they were doing this substitution practice because cannabis had better outcomes for them. It had less negative side effects. It had less chance of dependence and overdose, and it was more successful at treating their symptoms. So looking at this and putting it in the context of pharmaceutical drug use in the United States and the issues that we're seeing with the overuse of opiates and other painkillers, I was very interested in the possibility of cannabis acting as a substitute for some of these other drugs. So I continued to pursue that line of research with another study and an additional 350 patients, and found basically the same results. That study was then replicated again in Canada with a few thousand patients, and we found the same thing, that we were seeing very high rates of substitution, especially for pharmaceutical drugs. So I'm really interested from a research perspective in not only can cannabis be used as a substitute for opiates when it comes to things like post-surgical pain or chronic pain, but can we actually look at cannabis as a tool to help people who have dependence on opiates or are experiencing hazardous opiate use, to help them wean themselves off of opiates and actually look at it as a promising treatment for people that have opiate dependence? And so that's really where my research is going to go in the future, is to look at individuals who are claiming opiate dependence to see how their lives improve or don't when cannabis is introduced.
And how did the founders go from bicycle delivery to sustainability? Maybe you could shed a little light on the founders themselves and expand on the origins of the company a little bit more there.
Sure. So, you know, I would say that there is not a far leap at all from bicycle delivery to sustainability. I think that, you know, it really from the very beginning was how do we provide a product to the public that, first of all, is a clean product that's grown in an environmentally conscious way, but also being an environmentally conscious company. Our founder, Michael Steinmetz, who I met very early in 2015, you know, he had a successful stevia distribution company in his home country of Venezuela, and has always been very interested in creating an agricultural supply chain that is both efficient and is environmentally aware. And so as we build out our facilities up here in Mendocino County, we are doing it with an eye on sustainability, and whether that's creating opportunities for rain catchment systems or whether that's using solar power, we are trying to be a sustainable company in our processes as much as we're trying to support sustainably grown cannabis. And one of the ways that we support sustainably grown cannabis is through partnerships with companies like Dr. Bronner's. So Dr. Bronner's launched a cannabis line called Brother David's. It's focused on cannabis that has received this Sun and Earth certification that justifies and supports it as a regenerative cannabis farm. So really beyond organic to looking at ways to improve the land through farming. And so we helped Dr. Bronner's locate these farms, evaluate these farms, and then we distribute that product under the Brother David's line. So, you know, again, looking at all aspects of who we are as a company, not just the product that we're sourcing, but the way that we're actually running our business, really focused on sustainability and green production.
Yes, in regenerative agriculture, we had a guest on last week that talked extensively about this. And it's maybe a term that a lot of folks aren't familiar with. And I really love the fact that what you just said, that it's not just not causing harm, but it's actually improving the ground, improving the soil, improving its production capacity. So looking at this from the farmer's standpoint, what does the business of cannabis look like for producers post-prohibition? Can you touch on that a little?
Sure. You know, I think prohibition did some very interesting things to cannabis cultivation. One of the things it did is it drove a lot of cultivation indoors. We do not cultivate other plants in basements under high intensity lighting. We do cultivate cannabis that way. One of the reasons is because people had to hide it and they couldn't let anyone know what they were doing. And so they had to put it somewhere where they couldn't be found out. I think the other kind of artificial barrier is that there's no interstate commerce. So, you know, for example, I grew up in Michigan. We grew a whole lot of apples. We didn't grow any avocados because avocados don't grow in the climate of Michigan. We imported avocados from states and countries where they grow very well. Because we're not allowed to ship cannabis across state lines, states like Michigan and Illinois, who have legalized cannabis, are forced to grow it indoors or in artificial environments because cannabis does not grow with their natural climate. And so I think that the idea of growing cannabis indoors is going to remain until the borders fall and we're actually allowed to treat cannabis like any other crop, where it grows in a climate that is suitable and then it is shipped to other places where it is not suitable to grow it outdoors. So I think that that's one thing that happened to the growers under prohibition. But on kind of the silver lining of that is that the folks that were cultivating outdoors up in places like the Emerald Triangle, prohibition forced them to also hide, but it also forced them to be very creative when it came to staying clandestine. And so when we talk about regenerative farming, a lot of those regenerative farms started off as farms that didn't want to have large amounts of soil and electricity and water coming on and off the property because they didn't want to call attention to themselves. So it was much easier to dig your own pond, collect your own water, install solar panels, do all of your own compost, create all of your own soils. And in the process of doing this, they became regenerative farms. So what I see post-prohibition is that A, once the borders fall and we're actually allowed to treat cannabis like other crops, we'll see cultivation move out of the indoor facilities in places like Massachusetts and Michigan. And we'll see places like California, which can produce cannabis outdoors very well, take over as producing states. The other thing that I think we're going to see is more of a focus on regenerative agriculture through cannabis production and consumers wanting to obtain cannabis that is being grown consciously with an eye on the environment in a way that's promoting land and health. I think especially now with what we're seeing going on in the Amazon, people are really becoming more aware of the impact of their habits, their eating habits, their purchasing habits on the environment.
We're at that midway point. We're going to take a brief moment here. We'll be right back with Amanda Ryman of Flokana. This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm your host, Carol Murphy. Thank you so much for listening. And we are with Amanda. Hi again, Amanda.
Hi.
How else is Flokana using business as a force for good? And, you know, it's every time I breach this subject, because we've spoken before, I always have this, I don't know, little cloud over my head, kind of the remnants, the image of the prohibition and the illegal aspect of cannabis growing. Can cannabis really be used as a force for good? And how are you kind of battling that preconception of a lot of folks out there?
Well, I do think that cannabis can be used as a force for good, but I want to differentiate between cannabis and cannabis policy reform. Because I think that the cannabis plant absolutely is a force for good. And I think that a lot of the concerns that people had about legalization, that teen use would go up, have not materialized. We have not seen teen use go up across the country or in places where cannabis has been legalized. You know, we haven't seen, you know, significant increases in accidents and dependence and, you know, some of the other things that folks thought may happen post-legalization. So I think from a public health perspective, you know, we didn't see the sky fall. It will be some time before we really know the long-term impacts of legalization because the research takes a while to really see those impacts. But so far, it looks like legalization is doing what we wanted it to do. It's reducing arrests and people that are getting in trouble for cannabis. People who had cannabis on their records are getting those records expunged. And so now they're able to get jobs and they're able to get public housing and or they're able to get over the barriers that the collateral sanctions place on them for having drug felonies. So we are seeing those benefits. We're seeing tax revenue. So that, I think, is what we wanted to see from the cannabis plant. Now, I think cannabis policy reform also has a real opportunity to be used for good because I think it helps call attention to some very, very important social issues. And we already talked about environmentalism, right? So I think, you know, the discussion about sun-grown cannabis versus indoors versus, you know, should we have producing states? Should cannabis be grown everywhere? Is a really amazing opportunity to talk about environmentalism and to talk about cannabis as a plant. It's grown in the ground. How it's grown absolutely impacts the environment. We should be asking those questions. We should have high standards for how cannabis is produced. So I think that that is a conversation that is already happening. And then I think there's also amazing opportunities to have conversations about racial and economic equity as well. And, you know, we talk about who gets arrested for cannabis, and, you know, the ACLU and other organizations have done an amazing job looking at that data and really, you know, helping people understand that there is a huge racial disparity in who gets arrested for cannabis when we look at use rates, which are comparatively the same across races. So I think that that's one aspect that really kind of opens the door for conversation. But post-legalization, after it's legal and after we're not really talking about arrests anymore, I think there's still a very important conversation to be had. And it's one that Flokana is very much involved in, which is, what is this industry going to look like when the dust settles? Is it going to look like every other American industry that is being led mostly by white men who had wealth coming into it? Or is it going to actually give opportunities to people who have been most impacted by the drug war, who have been arrested for cannabis, who have had their opportunities limited because of the criminal justice context of cannabis? So I think that's really the next question when we talk about business for good, is what is this industry going to look like? And we have the opportunity to decide that now, but it's going quickly. And once that power takes hold, it's going to be very, very difficult to disrupt it.
Mm-hmm. And there is big money being, you know, poured into the cannabis industry right now. So like you said, people with a lot of money that are making more money. So there's also the consumer side, the consumer perspective. Is there a downside to legalization for consumers?
Well, price. I mean, price is absolutely a downside to legalization. It's more expensive because there's taxes. So when you buy cannabis on the illicit market, there's no tax. And you can talk, you know, you can negotiate. That doesn't happen when you walk into a store. The price is what it is. The tax is what it is. So I would say that that's been the hardest thing for consumers, especially for patients. You know, if you're somebody that's buying cannabis every now and again to bring to a party or to have on a weekend, I don't think the price is going to impact you as much. If you're somebody that relies on cannabis on a daily basis as a pain medicine, as I do, then it becomes really difficult when you see the taxes put in the picture. So I think that that is probably the hardest thing for the consumer. However, I will also say that the consumer is getting a whole lot for that. And what they're getting most of all is the assurance of safety. And, you know, we've seen this story blow up in the past week of folks who are having serious lung issues using unregulated vape pens. And so the ability to go into a store and to purchase a product that you know has gone through rigorous testing and is safe, you know, that's why we buy alcohol from liquor stores and not from like our friend who says that their friend makes really good liquor. It's because we know that if there's adulterants in that alcohol, it can cause us to get very sick. And so I think that the consumer is definitely hitting it, getting hit in the pocketbook, but at the same time, they're getting assurances about safety that we never had under prohibition.
And what does the future look like for Flokana? What do you have planned ahead?
Well, we really want to be a brand that is synonymous with the sun-grown craft farmer. And we want individuals to know that whenever they have a product, whether it's Flokana flower, or whether it's Dr. Bronner's Brother David's line, or Willie's Reserve, which is Willie Nelson's line, which is another line that we distribute for, that when they see that there's Flokana product inside, it means that they are supporting the independent network of craft farmers here in the Emerald Triangle. And we want to encourage consumers to ask questions at the dispensary about where their cannabis is grown. And we also want to encourage consumers to look at cannabis the way that they look at zucchini or the way that they look at strawberries. And I think that if we can really help make the connection in the consumer market and in the mind of the consumer that cannabis is a food, it is a plant, that you should be asking all the same questions and making all the same decisions that you do when you make decisions about fruits and vegetables. I think that is what we're really trying to accomplish.
And do the current founders anticipate another funding round? Do they have investors already, or was this endeavor bootstrapped?
Well, it was bootstrapped at the beginning. We're still a privately owned company, so we haven't taken any investment from any Canadian companies or any corporations. You know, we've been very fortunate to find angel investors and others privately who really believe in the work that we're doing. And so, you know, we're always going to be looking to expand and to grow. And a lot of how that happens in the future depends on what happens with policy. You know, we're a California company and we represent the Emerald Triangle region of California. There are only so many dispensaries in California. So we think it's really important that those borders do fall. And that way we're able to provide the country with this product that is grown regeneratively and is grown by these craft family farms. So I think that's really going to be the next step for a company like us.
Are you able to tell us how much you were able to raise previously?
Well, the last funding round, we were able to raise $125 million, which we were very fortunate. And like I said, you know, we found private investment that very much believes in our mission and believes that there needs to be a company that's really trying to connect cannabis cultivation and this farmer network with the larger issues related to climate change and environmentalism.
So Amanda, how might our listeners find you? We've come to the end of our time today, and I want to make sure that folks can find you.
Sure. Well, we have a website, which is www.flowcanna.com. And we just released the first in a four-part series called The Great Outdoor, which is a series of short films, just about 10 minutes long, that follows three of the family farms that we work with through the seasons. So we just released Spring, and that can be found on the website. And if people are interested in what I'm doing, you know, I'm on Twitter as Amanda Ryman, so you can follow me there. And then, of course, Flowcanna has Instagram and Facebook and all of that good social media.
Yeah, and those are wonderful little short films. I shared the first one on our Facebook page, and I just love it. This is Heartstock. Thank you, Amanda.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and thank you for listening. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5 Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 5 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via livestream at butteamericaradio.org.